Welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline Diest, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. Welcome to Right Through the Roof, and today I'm talking to Dave Hutchinson. How are you going, Dave?
I'm fine. How are you, Madeline?
Very good, thank you. A little introduction about Dave. So Dave is a sci-fi writer, originally from Sheffield. He's been a journalist for over 25 years, and he's been publishing short stories, novellas and novels since the late 70s. His Fractured Europe series has been nominated for lots of different awards, with the third in series, Europe in Winter, winning the British Sci-Fi Association Award for Best Novel in 2016. And his space opera novella, Acadie, is currently out now. Thanks for coming on the show, Dave.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Excellent.
So it's great to be anywhere.
So let's start off with a few warm-up questions, you know, some kind of side bends, some... you know, jogging on the spot, get you limbered up. So you've written short stories, novellas, novels. Which is your favourite?
I think I'm a natural short story writer, actually, which is weird because I've spent the last 4 or 5 years writing almost nothing but novels. But I think by nature I am a short story writer. And I really should get back into doing that.
Why do you think that is?
I've got an enormously short attention span. I get bored very easily. And a novel is something for people with a lot of stamina, which I don't have. I like the concision that you get with a short story, where everything has to be sort of told or implied or painted in or sketched in, I don't know, 2,000 words or 6,000 words or 10,000 words is a bit baggy, but that kind of thing. And I used to really enjoy writing short stories, and I haven't done it for a long time. And I would like to, if I ever have time again, I would like to get back into writing short stories and do a proper collection.
Good. So what's your favourite time of the day to write?
Probably late at night when there are less distractions. Any time from, I don't know, 8 o'clock in the evening till, I don't know, 1. I have become a lot more sensible in recent years. I used to work during the day and come home at 6, have dinner, have a bath, and then write until 3 in the morning, and then go to work the next day. And I would do that night after night after night. But I'm getting too old to maintain that kind of lifestyle. I need my sleep. So I'm being a bit more sensible now.
Okay.
I'm definitely sort of a night owl as far as that's concerned. There's too many distractions during the day.
And are you a plotter or a pantser?
A bit of both. I usually start out with a vague idea of what I'm doing, but the moment I start writing, that tends to go out of the window, and I just wing it. I think it probably annoys my publishers enormously, because I submit synopses of the next novel, and they say, oh, here's a synopsis of Dave's novel, and he must know what he's doing. But by the time the book comes out, it bears almost no relation to the synopsis. it's kind of just a jumping off point more than anything else. Something to get me, I don't know, in the mood, get my mind focused.
Good. And so finally, in the warm-up questions, do you have a writing fuel of choice?
Nicotine.
Yeah.
I smoke far too much. I'm not one of these people who can write. I'm not one of these people who sort of writes with a jug of coffee at his elbow, because coffee makes me extremely twitchy. Mm. I find two or three coffees a day and I'm climbing the walls. Mm. Again, I think this is because I'm getting old, I think. But yes, I do need to have cigarette breaks at regular intervals, otherwise I start shouting at the cat.
But smoking also, doesn't it? It, as long as you're not on the internet as well, gives you that little break to have a think, doesn't it? Because there's nothing else that you're generally doing.
Yeah. I mean, it is good to sort of stand up, walk around, look at something else, look out of the window. You know, let your mind go blank for a while. And that's when the interesting stuff happens, when you're not thinking about it. Yeah, you know, I'll tend to go out for a walk in the afternoon for, you know, a couple of hours. You know, do a bit of shopping, just wander around the local park and not think about what I'm writing. Because that's when things, you know, ideas sort of pop into your head, when you're not thinking too hard about it. So yeah, having a break is great, so long as it's not too long.
Good. Okay, so let's get a little more in depth. So how do you describe your writing, and are there particular themes that you like to explore?
I've always basically just described my writing as science fiction, because that's what I do. I enjoy reading science fiction, and that's the stuff I write, even though I've sort of dipped my toe in space opera and in fantasy. I wrote an erotic fantasy short story for somebody's collection once, which was ridiculous, because I'm hopeless at erotica, and I really can't write fantasy. And I missed the deadline on that by 6 months. By the time I'd finished it, the book had come out, so it was kind of wasted effort almost. But no, I just describe it as science fiction, and I don't think I have any. I don't consciously have any themes. I don't think it's every story is kind of different. And obviously, for the past few years, when I've been writing the Europe books, the themes have been along the lines of statehood and geopolitics and the dreadful mess that Europe is going through at the moment, and Britain in particular, and stuff like that. But I don't think there's an overarching... I mean, so somebody brighter than me could probably read my stuff and say, yes, you really do have a theme. These are your concerns. But I don't consciously have any.
Mm-hmm. And your Europe books have almost been prophetic, haven't they?
Yeah, completely by accident. I started writing the first one, Europe in Autumn. Oh, it must be 15 years ago now. And I was just sort of writing a bit and putting it away and picking it up and writing it again and stuff. And it's kind of only if I'd finished it 10 years ago, if I'd been quicker writing it, it would have had no relevance at all. But it's kind of because of what's been happening over the past couple of years, they've kind of picked up a relevance. I'm not sure they deserve. I mean, they are near future thrillers, and that's what they're meant to be. I wasn't aiming to be prophetic, but you know, that's the world we live. That's the world we live in at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move on to the main question that I like to ask everyone. So, what is the one thing that you think has been most helpful in improving your writing?
I've been thinking really hard about this since I saw the questions that you sent me, and I have no idea. I honestly can't tell you. I mean, I've the one piece of advice I always give people who say to me, you know, how can I be a better writer? The one piece of advice I always give them is read a lot, and then write something that you would be happy to read, something that would satisfy you as a reader. Because that's what I've always tried to do. I've tried to write something that I would be, it would make me feel I've done something really good with my time if I've read it. I've not always succeeded. I don't think I've succeeded most of the time, but that's what I've tried to do. That's what I tried to do with the Europe books anyway. I wanted to write a thriller. I wanted to write a spy novel. And I wanted to write the kind of spy novel that I would have enjoyed reading. And the same with Akkadi. I wanted to write a space. What happened with Akkadi was that Tor.com had an open submission period for space operas. And I don't tend to write space opera very often. I did one a few years ago called The Push. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, I fancy doing another space opera. I'll see if I can, you know, it was a break from what I was doing at the time. I'll see if I can do a novella, and I'll do a space opera. And I had a couple of ideas kicking around on bits of paper. So I wrote it, and I wanted to write something that I would enjoy reading, something which would appeal to me, something that, you know, would make me happy. And that's what I've always tried to do. Don't write for anybody else. Just write for yourself. Write the kind of stuff that you would enjoy reading. You know, you're your own best critic. You know in your head what a good book is, and try and be that good book.
Good. So when you were preparing for the space opera, did you do a bunch of reading, as you just talked about?
No. I mean, I've spent the best part of my life reading science fiction, the best years. So I've read my share of space opera. I tend to kind of rankle against these divisions within science fiction. A space opera novella is still a science fiction novella, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. And, you know, deep down, it's all still writing. Mm-hmm. It's all writing, whether it's Stephen King or Graham Greene or John le Carré. It's all writing. Mm. And you have to take the same amount of care no matter what genre you're writing in.
So you read widely as well?
Yeah, I try to. The past few years, I've been one of the judges for the Crime Writers Association debut Dagger Award. So for the past few years, I've been reading nothing but crime fiction, which has been an interesting experience. And I'm also one of the judges for this year's Arthur C. Clarke Award. So I'm receiving megatons of science fiction novels, some of which I'd already bought, which has annoyed me enormously.
I bought
these books, and they're on a to-be-read pile, and then they're being sent to me for nothing, which is, anyway, in one way it's great, because at least I've read them already. Mm. But I haven't done an awful lot of reading for fun for a very long time. And once I've finished with this, I'm just going to spend a year reading for fun.
Well, hopefully quite a lot of those novels that you're having to read for those awards are fun as well.
Oh, yeah, immensely. There is some – I'm not sure how much I can say, but there are some very good novels, yeah.
So what writers – you talked about how you like to read a lot. So what writers have inspired you, and why in particular?
Len Deighton.
Oh, really?
I just love the dialogue and the sort of the low-key plotting. I just love the first four Deighton novels, I think, are some of the best espionage fiction ever written. Mm. They are beautifully written as well. John le Carré, who is obviously the governor. Raymond Chandler. I love Raymond Chandler. again, the sheer joy of the writing. The writing, Chandler writes like a dream. Mm. Even though his plotting sometimes is so convoluted that even he didn't know who did it. there was actually a story that I can't remember. Is it The Long Goodbye? One of the novels sort of revolves around the investigation of the murder of a character, a chauffeur. And when they were making a film of it back in the 40s, I suppose, they were trying to get the script done, and they couldn't work out who'd actually done the murder from the book. So they called Chandler. Allegedly, they called Chandler. I said, look, Ray, could you tell us who actually killed Rusty Regan? And he said, well, I don't know. But he'd made the book so complicated that even he didn't know. Well, I think that was marvellous. Absolutely marvellous. In science fiction, I love Christopher Priest's work. I think The Prestige in particular is probably one of the best books written in English of any kind in the past 50 years. I think it's a marvellous, marvellous book. Who else? Keith Roberts, who I think was an absolutely outstanding writer. And he kind of taught me that English people can write science fiction, because up to the point where I'd started to read him, I'd read nothing but American science fiction writers, and so to my mind, the world of science fiction was just American, and everybody in it, all the characters and the heroes and the villains, everybody was American. And then I read a novel by Keith Roberts called Pavane, which is set in Dorset, and I was kind of rocked back on my heels by this. I thought, oh my God, English people do this as well. And it's a terrific book. I provide, I think, it's an absolute masterpiece. But I tracked down some of his short stories as well. And his short stories are about people who they run petrol stations and sort of provincial flea pit cinemas, and you know, it's science fiction about ordinary people like me. Mm-hmm. They're not sort of out crossing the galaxy destroying solar systems, and that really was a light bulb moment for me. And it's that kind of thing has, I think, had a enormous effect on what I write about and how I write, certainly about the characters I write about anyway, or try to.
That's really interesting, because I grew up with Doctor Who, so I, you know, for me, it's always a Brit at the forefront of sci-fi. So it's just really interesting.
Well, the first science fiction I read was The First Man in the Moon, H.G. Wells. And then I went on to War of the Worlds, obviously, then The Time Machine, and then 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And then I kind of made the leap to Asimov and Heinlein and Larry Niven, and they kind of occupied my mind for quite a long time. I read everything that Asimov had written, all the short stories, all the novels. I read as much of Heinlein as I could stand, which is quite a lot at the time. Larry Niven, I worship Larry Niven. Again, for the dialogue, some of Larry Niven's dialogue I thought was terrific. And there was a kind of breezy Southern California air to his stuff. And I, you know, as far as I was concerned, the future was American. Mm. And then I suddenly discovered Keith Roberts, and he led me on to people like J.G. Ballard, Chris Priest, M. John Harrison. So, you know, absolutely outstanding writers who I'd had no idea existed until then. So, yeah, I'm it really did sort of change the way I looked at science fiction and my writing.
Okay. So moving on to talking about Akadi. So what inspired Akadi, and were you trying anything different? Well, you talked a bit before about it was a space opera, but from a writing perspective, did you try anything different?
Not particularly, no. It's a first-person novella. I've done first-person before. I'm actually more comfortable writing in first-person than I am in any other way, really. Mm. I feel happier doing that. And it's weird that the novels have actually not been in the first person. I almost started to do European Autumn in the first person and then realised it would not work at all. But I don't think I tried anything experimental or anything strange or weird. I just had a story that I wanted to tell. Mm. And it's a very simple story, but it's kind of got, you know, a good heart. It's got a sense of humour. There's a couple of good gags in it as well. So,
and what was the inspiration behind the story?
Oh, I can't. I don't think there was an inspiration. There is a twist, and I'm sure it's a twist which has been done before. In fact, I can almost think that I'm sure there's a Fred Pohl short story where something similar like that happens, but I can't remember what it is. No, I don't think there was anything. There was anything in particular. It was just there. Mm. It's always hard to kind of pin down inspirations and stuff, because 90% of the time you're not aware what they are.
Mm.
And it's only sometimes years go by.
Mm.
And you'll see an old film that you watched years ago and think, oh, that's where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
I understand now. A lot of it is subconscious, and you don't realise where things are coming from. At least I don't.
Mm. But the name itself came from.
Oh, yes. There's a Daniel Lanois album called Akadi, which I loved the title. And I always wanted to have a story titled Akadi. Mm. It's just a wonderful word. It was the name of, let me get this right, it's the name of the French colony in North America, or a French colony in North America. And it kind of fits the novella is about a colony in space, but it's just a nice word. It's got a great ring to it. It's got a nice snap to it. I like it. And for years, I mean, it could have wound up sort of stuck on another story, but it wound up with on this one.
Great. So in wrapping up, I'll let you get back to your writing, seeing it's late night in London. It's probably your writing time right now. So what are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, I'm working on the fourth Europe book, which is being a bit of a sod with me. it's not been an easy book to write. I've overshot the deadline by although to be fair, my publishers have been very, very good about it, and they've not been hassling me. It's about 80% done, I think. It's getting there, but it's been a hard thing to. I ditched about 30,000 words and a subplot and two characters because they just didn't fit somehow. I couldn't sort of see the way it was all coming together. This has been a really tough one. But it's getting there slowly.
Why do you think it's been so difficult?
I have no idea. And I had a synopsis. Excuse me. I had a synopsis. And it's not a bad synopsis, really. But when I actually started to write it, it just didn't hang together. There was no... You know when you get a book and you read it and you want to you want to read it so much you can't stop turning the pages and you're reading it on the train and you miss your stop because you want to read more and you don't go to bed because you want to finish it. Mm. This is not one of those books.
Yes.
Well, no. When I was writing Europe at Midnight, which I wrote very, very quickly, I wanted to write it. I couldn't wait to get back into it and push the story forward and do it. And I was staying up until all hours doing it, and I was going to libraries and I was writing it, and I was having a great time. This one, I find a kind of reluctance to get back into it, and I'm not sure why. Mm. It will get done, and it will be as good as I can make it. I think part of it is it's going to be the final Europe book, and I want to go out without disappointing people. Mm. I don't want people to say, "Oh, we should have stopped at 3. Mm-hmm. I want to say, "Well, yeah, maybe you should have stopped at 3, but 4, it's not too bad." Mm. Something like that.
So that added pressure.
Yeah, I mean, it's self-imposed pressure as well. Nobody's sort of poking me or shouting at me or anything. It's just in my own head. But it has been a tough one. It really has. And I spent today rewriting the ending, because I already had the ending, and I've already sort of had to downgrade. There's a kind of twist at the end, and I've had to downgrade it and rewrite that because I looked at it one day and thought, no, that's ridiculous. That's impossible. It wouldn't happen. It couldn't happen. So I've had to come up with something else. Mm. It will get done. But...
No, I think it's really great that you're being so open about your struggles with it on this call anyway, because when other people hear this, I'm sure they'll appreciate to know that they're not alone if they're going through something similar.
Oh, no. I mean, I've always said I find writing enormously difficult. I'd rather do anything else than write, to be honest with you. It's an enormous strain physically, just the typing. Mm. I find a strain, but actually sort of sitting down and writing and getting things right, I find it enormously difficult. I'm an enormously lazy writer.
Picked an interesting career then.
yeah. Yeah, but it's what I do. It's the only thing I can do. I'm not sure how I wound up doing this, but it's what I wound up doing. Mm. You know, as you say, 25 years on Fleet Street. Mm. I've just been writing my whole life. Mm. It's the only thing I can do with any great facility.
Even though it's really tough for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I had any talent as a plumber, I'd probably be doing that rather than writing. But I don't. You know, if you asked me to put your boiler in, he'd probably blow your house up. If he asked me to write a Sorry?
I was going to say, you still got time to retrain, you know, go through your apprenticeship?
Oh, no, I'm far too old. I'm almost a pensioner. No, they wouldn't take me on, no. No, no, but I mean, if you ask me to write something for you, I will turn out something passable. If you ask me to make a table, you know, forget it. I'm utterly inept with my hands.
Okay.
You should just see some. You should see some of the decorating I've done here. It's awful.
Dave Hutchinson, good writer, bad DIY man.
Absolutely awful, bad DIY man. Yes. So, not so great writer, really. But
oh, come on. All right. So
I'm a better writer than I'm a plumber. Put it like that.
That sounds like a quote for this episode.
He's a better writer than he's a plumber. Yeah, I've settled that. I always have that on my gravestone. He was a better writer than he was a plumber. That will do me, actually. I'm happy with that.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. I'm glad we could give you something tonight. So in order to stop you procrastinating and get you back into that, into the horrible story that's causing you drama, let's wrap up. So where can people find you and your work?
The books are available on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Or some of them, anyway, most of them. I'm on Twitter, really only for the very, very brave, because I just ramble about Brexit and politics, and I occasionally insult the US president. But I haven't actually been on Twitter for quite a while because I've been so busy. Mm-hmm. But I'm at Hutchinson Dave. Mm-hmm. I am for my sins Davy Six Toes on Twitter.
Why that? Well, I can actually ask you this right now.
Oh, why Davy Six Toes?
Yeah.
Oh, back in the day, on Facebook, there was a mafia name generator doing the rounds. It was just sort of, you know, you type your name in and it would come up with your mafia name.
Oh, okay.
And I did that, and it was Davy Six Toes. And one of my Facebook friends started actually calling me Davy Six Toes. And so when I sort of started with Twitter, I just sort of foolishly put that as my handle or tag or whatever it is, and it's kind of stuck.
Whether you actually had six toes.
Well, this is the story that people always ask me this. My grandmother had six toes on each foot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and she had webbed hands.
Oh, very Lovecraftian.
Apparently, yes. I keep wondering if I'm not going to be taken back by the elder gods. Actually, I wish they would take me back, to be honest with you. I never actually knew my grandmother, but according to my father, she had six toes on each foot and webbed fingers.
Oh, there you go.
It's a miracle I don't have tentacles, to be honest with you. And horns.
All right, Dave. So
a face like an octopus.
Yeah, well, that's why I actually don't know what to say to that.
It's late. It's late here, Madeline, and I'm starting to hallucinate. I don't know.
All right. So people can find your Twitter or your work on Amazon. But I will let you get back to your day. So it is late, but thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, today's tip is no internet before writing. Now, I've heard this advice a number of times before I actually implemented it. I'm sure there's some psychological study about how many times we need to hear something before we truly hear it, and it's probably got something to do with advertising. But eventually it was an interview with the psychologist Jim Quick, which ultimately encouraged me to give this a go, in conjunction with my 5 a.m. Writers Club experiment, to get my 1 hour of editing in before work. Now, there's science behind why this is a good idea to go straight into creative work after waking up, but by not checking emails or social media before I started a writing session, I'm finding it easier to concentrate. My mind is clear of my to-do list or creating a witty 280-character comeback. I make a coffee, I do a few stretches, and then I get typing. Now, my experience has been that it's easier to focus and get into the flow of writing with no distractions earlier, and the time seems to fly by. And when I do get around to checking my feeds, as another writer mentioned to me on Twitter. Oh, yes, the irony. Once I get there, the internet seems really scattered and meaningless. But the benefit for me is the quality of the work first thing in the morning, and then that really nice, clear feeling of having done all my work before I head off to the day job. So maybe this is something you can try yourself. So get straight into writing without checking the internet first. Thanks for listening to Write Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?